The following is a point of view program. Opinions expressed are those of the participants.
You know, talking to males is just like, why does this bother you so much that someone ripped apart your grant? And it's like, I mean, yeah, I know it's not anything against me personally, but it's hard to hear all that criticism all at once. And basically, I feel like I suck, I can't do this at all. And they seem to have this way of brushing it off and being able to be like, okay, yeah, it's fine. Okay, I can fix it up and I can make it great.
You're listening to In Other Words on Montana Public Radio. I'm Dr. Ann Zaldapetri, and tonight, in what I hope is the first of many conversations with women scientists, I have a phone conversation with Dr. Shayla Katadia about women in science. Dr. Katadia has a very long resume for a 33-year-old, and also many thoughts on what the barriers are to keeping women employed as academic scientists. Stay with us.
Katadia, and I went to undergraduate at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and majored in cell and structural biology, which no longer exists. It's basically molecular and cellular biology. Then after that, I went straight to graduate school at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center and got a PhD in genetics and development. After that, I took 6 months off just to do whatever I wanted, which was great. And then I did my postdoctoral fellowship at the University of California, Santa Cruz, which ended about a little over a year ago. And for like the past 10 months or so prior to coming to my current position, I was the science policy fellow at the American Society for Biochemistry and Molecular Biology. And 2 months ago, I started in my current position, which is the Education and Outreach Manager at the Synthetic Biology Engineering Research Center.
That is a mouthful, and you are very accomplished for one so young.
I was like that. As I was saying it, it seemed like more than I had thought it was.
It's fantastic. And the reason that I wanted to talk to you, to interview you for In Other Words, was because of our emphasis on women, and especially women in science. And you know a ton about that. So I wanted to talk to you and ask you some questions about what it's like currently for young women scientists and what barriers they have and what maybe benefits they have and what that's all like. But before we jump into that, I'm curious about what it's been like for you, or if there's been special are different experiences that you've had by virtue of being female than maybe your male peers haven't?
Yeah, by being virtue of a female, that's an interesting way. I feel like that's an interesting way to put it. So most of my career, I've been well supported, and I have had male bosses, but they've been really respectful, and I don't think it's been a problem, but I had some issues because I dress very trendy, you could say, and so I know I get a lot of comments about that, and I feel like one is due to people in science never dressing up, but I think a lot of it had to do also with me being a woman in science. I'm trying to think, you know, my past is very back and forth, like I've been all over, and I think that what I've done differently from a lot of women, or what you tend to hear about from women in science, is that I decided to just go where I wanted to go until now. I came back to Berkeley because Justin is there, my boyfriend is there, but I did choose to just follow what I thought was best, which time I probably didn't think was best, but it was what I wanted to do.
And you think that that is different from what your female counterparts do?
Yeah, I think it's different from a lot of my friends that I've spoken to, or, well, and everybody's different, right? Because now I'm seeing a lot of my friends, and I'm thinking of all my friends, and everybody's had a little bit different scenario. But I think generally what happens is that women often decide, okay, I'm not going to go the faculty route, right? So you get a PhD in science, and then you do this postdoc, and not everyone's going to become a faculty member. I think the statistics now are between 10 and 20% will become faculty in academia. But a lot of the reasons for that is because relationships get in the way or location gets in the way. Most of the times it's getting married to someone and having kids, and I have done neither of those yet, and I'm happy for that decision, but I think that weighs a lot of opinions about what path they're going to take or what future they're going to have, and I think that happens more with women than men, and I think there's a variety of reasons for that.
Talk about what that variety of reasons are. My grammar is terrible.
Don't worry, mine is too, so we're even. it's funny because I'm now in this education outreach position, which I have a lot of leeway in. And one of the things we've been talking about is better understanding why women don't go the academic route, and if it's a choice and what influences those choices. And the other day we made this long list. You know, there was, what was on the list? So it was family. It's also the mentors you encounter throughout your career, the gender of your mentor. I think another big one is the career of your spouse, because I didn't realize this, but recently I had read somewhere that men in academia or in STEM academia tend to marry women that have part-time jobs or are stay-at-home more frequently than women who would have a husband who does that. And women who are at these higher-level positions, get their PhDs, do postdocs, go into academia, they tend to be married to someone who also has a very demanding job. So then it's even more difficult to take care of the children, because presumably they become the primary caretaker. And men may not necessarily have the same family dynamic. And there's also, you know, maybe you're not getting equal pay, and maybe women don't want the... It's funny, because I feel kind of strange saying women as a collective, because everybody has a different opinion. But me personally, because I went on one faculty interview, and it just seems so miserable now to have that type of job, because you're just fighting for funding and having to write grants all the time. And I made the choice that I didn't really want to do that, that I wasn't going to follow through and try to apply for more jobs or wait another year to apply for more faculty positions, that I was going to take a different opportunity, which was the policy fellowship. And so maybe women... I don't know, maybe women are smart in that regard, that they want more work-life balance. I also found when I was writing a grant and I spoke to other women about writing grants, that it was always, we were more personally tied to them, and maybe it was more difficult to get through the process than men.
Interesting.
And that personally was true for me. But maybe not others.
Okay, so you brought up so many points that are absolutely fascinating to me. Starting with the idea that men in academic positions tend to marry women who have half-time jobs or part-time jobs, while women in academic positions tend to marry men with full-time demanding jobs.
Yeah, and I guess I should clarify, it's not 10-2, it's just the percentage is higher for men to not marry women who have higher positions. So it's not necessarily the majority, but it's a higher percentage.
Wow. And thanks for correcting me from one statistician to another. That's great.
No, it's like, I might have said it wrong too.
No, I start to, you know, get into that layperson's loose language, and it's fun to talk to other scientists and it reels you back in. But I think that reflecting on my own situation, that is true of Alan and I. And we were in graduate school together. I don't know if you know the story already, Shayla, but
I don't. I'm interested.
And so is everyone listening to, in other words. But we were in graduate school together, and Alan was a year ahead of me in the program. And when he graduated, he was invited to do an interim faculty position for a person who was stepping into the dean position. And it was a 3-year thing. And it seemed like a great idea because we were dating, and but he was done and he had gone on a couple of different interviews, mostly back east, and had been offered some positions. But that would have meant us being separated for a year, you know, which we could have dealt with, but it wasn't preferable. So he then took that 3-year interim position and I finished up my PhD. And when he was done, he was invited to apply for the full-time position and got it. And as a result of him doing that, of that one step, my entire academic career was in a sense derailed, because I had always imagined having an academic position and finishing up with graduate school and going on. And I imagined myself, you know, at some liberal arts college with an ivy color covered office and teaching undergraduates and having a lab and doing all the things that I had trained to do. But Alan's job took precedence because he had it. And we all know how difficult it is to come by those jobs. So ever since, I've been writing grants and putting together different positions into some sort of semblance of an academic position until I was hired in 2005 to work full-time for Walla Walla University. And it's an academic position, but we're a satellite campus. So I teach at a master's in social work program in Missoula, but for a university that's in Washington. So I'm not in the heart of academia. You know, there isn't that kind of pulse to it and that kind of excitement and that kind of academic discourse and exchanges. Although it's a fantastic job. I can't complain in the least. The students are wonderful and the experience is very enriching, but it isn't traditional at all. And Alan and I have talked a lot about what I perceive to be that sacrifice. And I'm not sure he sees it as a sacrifice, because we got the opportunity to raise our children in Missoula, Montana, and we both have academic jobs in the same small college town, which is a real rarity. It's almost impossible to come by. And yet I do miss the experience of what I had dreamed to be throughout my young adulthood. And so when you talk about that pattern or those percentages, that is really true for us, and not through any intentional sexism or devaluing of my job, but it almost always seems like that's just sort of how the dice rolls and that's how it ends up.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because I probably have the opposite story, which might make you mad, because I guess I had the choice, because I've had other women say that, like, oh, why did you leave, and you shouldn't go back, and because with my case, well, Justin, I'm ahead of Justin, and by a few years, because he teched after undergraduate. But he, you know, we were both in Santa Cruz together, and he finished his PhD and then had the choice of, where should I go for a postdoc? And while he did apply everywhere, he did concentrate on the West Coast and then ended up at Berkeley. And then a year later, I started applying for things, and I don't know, I know I needed a job. I was 3.5 years into my postdoc. My fellowship was going to end. My boss didn't have a ton of money, so either I could stick around for another year with a huge pay cut, or I could move on. And I thought it would be best to move on because I was ready to. And I knew it would take me about a year to get a job. So by the time I moved on, it was about 4.5 years into my postdoc. And I chose to go across the country, which was great. And, you know, we did talk about it, and the idea was it was what was best for me. It was a good opportunity. And if it didn't work out, it didn't work out. That was just how it was going to go. But that's also that was also our motivation for not getting married. Well, I think both of us don't want to have kids right now yet. And so I did that, but while I was there, it made me reevaluate everything. And I did decide to come back to the Bay Area and come to Berkeley. And now it's weird because I don't know what Justin's going to do in a few years, but I've made it clear that I don't want to live in, like, I want to live in a city. I like cities, and I don't want to live, I want to live on a coast. And, you know, who knows what's going to happen or if he's going to get it. You know, if he gets a faculty job, does that mean I have to do what you did, or what happened if I have a good job at Berkeley, but now I'm more mobile because my position could be available almost anywhere, and I have room to move around with what I do. And I'm kind of nervous about those questions because, like you said, you saw it as a sacrifice. I also see it as a sacrifice, and when I moved back here, I refused to move just for personal reasons, because that is something I never really wanted to do in life. And I had to have a good offer for a job that I really knew I would love, and it worked out for me. I got really lucky. So I'll need it to work out again, and I don't know if I used up all my luck, but I see where you're coming from, and I think that does happen quite a bit.
I don't want you to think that the story, your story, makes me mad at all. I am very glad that you're thinking of it that way, because it will save you possibly some bitterness and some issues to be worked out in relationship later in life. But it's also true that as I watch young women going through the process now and getting academic jobs, that the vision that I had of academia when I started graduate school in 1988 is not, in fact, the job that it is currently. And I don't know that I would be happy in the job that Alan has, with the pressure to write grants and the pressure to publish and the kind of reduced attention that it's possible to spend, at least in some institutions, on teaching. It really is kind of a pressure cooker, and I don't know that I would have wanted that for 25 years, although, you know, I would have liked the opportunity to find out, I guess. But
yeah, and I think that's sort of where I remember coming back from the one faculty interview, and it was at an institution that you did teach a lot, and I wasn't interested in a ton of teaching. I was more interested in just having my lab and doing research and then maybe teaching a course or two. So a good state research institution, but everyone's stories, and even just asking around at all different types of departments and all different schools, how much pressure it is, seeing how stressed my friends that have just started their labs are. They say they love their jobs, and I'm sure they do, and it's what they want to do, but I didn't want to be working 12 to 15 hour days constantly feeling this pressure of having to get tenure, and then when I'm not working, feeling guilty for not being at work. Now, when I go home, I usually have everything wrapped up, or, you know, good to go, know what I'm going to do the next day. I feel like accomplishing a lot, but I still have time to come home and sort of relax, go to my dance class, or hang out with Justin, just anything I want, I choose to do, and that was really important to me. And yeah, honestly, I don't find academic tenure track positions very attractive. It's not what I envisioned when I wanted to become a professor in undergrad and during grad school, I think my opinion started to change a lot at the end of grad school and in my postdoc.
If you think in the final analysis, if there is a gender bias towards being able to do that academic job well, which direction it swings?
Yeah, I think it swings towards preferable for the male or preferable towards a personality that can really, I don't even know if it's handling stress, but being able to have that unwavering confidence. Mm-hmm. That you can complete all these things, you'll do well, you'll devote all your time to it. I just find that men tend to, like when you talk of, when I was referring to writing grants before, when I talk to both sexes and, talking to males is just like, why does this bother you so much that someone ripped apart your grant? And it's like, I mean, yeah, I know it's not anything against me personally, but it's hard to hear all that criticism all at once. And basically, I feel like I suck, I can't do this at all. And they seem to have this way of brushing it off and being able to be like, okay, yeah, it's fine. Okay, I can fix it up and I can make it great. And I didn't have that ability. Even though I would be upset and a day or two later I would approach it again. I didn't like that feeling. I could do what my male counterpart could do. I could pick myself up and fix it up and make it better. But what I went through maybe emotionally wasn't the same. And I think that does work to their advantage. I think having that unwavering confidence helps you just handle everything better. And that probably helps, that probably like seeps into handling stress and time commitments. And I also feel like when you're in those positions, because there's not, in many departments, because there's not as many female PIs, you're asked to do more because you could be a role model for the other females, or, it's nice to have female representation on more panels, and it's great that departments want to do that, but then at the same time, you're getting more overworked than your male counterpart.
Boy, those are such great points. And even in the presentations at conferences, I can remember, especially early on, presenting and having people just wanting to rip apart your design.
Yeah.
And find a million holes, and walking down off the stage just feeling pretty devastated, and watching my male peers have that same thing and almost think it was fun.
Yeah. And, I don't understand that.
Yeah. Does it? It's such a good point that the emotional toll is different. And I have to jump to the conclusion, I guess I don't have to, but I want to jump to the conclusion that that is because the structure is very male created and very male dominated. So that idea of it being a fight, I don't know, maybe that's too stereotypical. Maybe that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I think it's more that the personalities of science are very self-selected and this perpetual cycle that the people who get selected for science are the ones who can withstand that. And because they can withstand it, they put it out. And then, it just continues that way. And if it happens to be more males, but I also find that, I mean, of course you get all different personalities of science, not just one stereotype, but you do see that sort of it factor somewhere in there.
Yeah, that's definitely true of the superstars of science, which everybody knows who they are at every conference. They have that that sparkle or something, that charisma. Maybe that comes with it, that ability to withstand criticism without blinking an eye.
the thing we've been talking about is how you change that and how you change a culture. And what are, how do you pinpoint those factors that we're trying to pinpoint? And is it, do you talk to the postdocs who decided not to go into academia? Those postdocs, women and male, that couldn't get into it, or the ones that did get into it and start to pull out commonalities? I don't know if anyone's ever really done that.
That's an interesting study. Expect if you were to run something like that, what do you think the factors are?
I mean, I know it's like everybody hates hearing this, but I think one big thing is going to be childcare. Okay, so if we take that off the table,
we don't have to take that off the table as far as I'm concerned, because
like, I don't know how much you want to talk about that.
No, that's, it's fine with me, because that definitely was a big issue for me and for us, and more than just the cost, it's finding quality childcare, but also being able to admit that there's only so many hours in the day, and you're going to need to put your kids in some sort of daycare situation for 8 to 10 hours.
Yeah, and where do you do that? Does the university offer childcare? Do you get extra childcare if you have to go to a conference? Because you want to present at a conference, and it's good for your professional development and to get your research out there. And, you know, you might not be able to leave for a week because you don't have anyone to watch your kids. And how do you get around that? So I think that's one major issue, but I don't think it's the only issue. I also think it's, so the way I operate, I want to know what's expected of me. You know, if I'm going to get tenure, I want to know what do I need to do, and I want, you know, nice paperwork and being able to read what I need to do and have it very clear. And I think sometimes that maybe, I mean, I've never been in an academic position, but I can imagine that's murky sometimes. And I feel like women are more detail oriented, and so maybe they would want that. So it's the way a department is set up. The fact that there are less women in these positions, so entering a department that's predominantly male might be hard for some women. And I think it's also just being new at a job, you know, taking that to faculty, you don't really know what you're doing. So if you are terrible at budgeting, that's going to be bad, because you're about to get, you know, you might get a $1 million budget soon that you have to figure out how to work that, when you have no clue because you've never had to do that before. And I think, so it's a lot of things like what support are you given, and how much do women need support in certain areas versus men in other areas, and what are different departments offering? Because if your department is primarily male and you have a setup for them, then it might not work for a female that's entering the department.
Are there other factors that come into play?
You know, maybe if a female is in a female's lab, that might be more encouraging to help them through the pipeline. And maybe that's not as feasible as a male being in a male's lab. But having said that, I've had a lot of great mentors, and a lot of them have been male, and I really appreciate how they've helped me throughout my career. But it is different speaking to a female mentor than a male mentor, mm-hmm. and how you can relate to one another. There's always the idea of equal pay, which in STEM, it's a smaller gap. I think there's a study on that, that in STEM, there's a smaller gap between men and women's pay, but women still get paid less. So I don't know, if you're not getting compensated a lot, then I would think you would want you know, that does influence what you do, especially as you get older. I don't know. Do you have any other ideas that I haven't listed?
No, I think you pretty much covered them. I wonder sometimes too about time spent forging and caretaking relationships versus time spent actually doing research, actually reading literature, and actually spending time in the lab, you know, doing things like breeding fruit flies and stuff like that. 'Cause I feel like when I was writing grants and supporting myself through that, it seemed like I had to spend a lot more time, and I'm not sure if it was more than my male counterparts, but it seemed like it, talking to my grant officer and checking in, and then talking to the people that were collecting data in the field and making sure that they felt good about everything. And I don't know, it seemed like my male counterparts were not concerned with the emotional well-being of their team. And again, that's sort of stereotypical again too, so I apologize for that, but I did wonder about that, because sometimes when it comes down to it, a half an hour a day can make a really big difference.
Yeah. And I think that's the whole idea of being detail-oriented as well. Mm-hmm. Like, I think females really want to be very detail-oriented, whereas, it's hard too. Like you were saying, it's very stereotyping of gender, and it's hard to separate, is that a gender thing or a personality thing or just an individual-based thing? But I think it does, I think that does make a difference, how you approach it. When I was writing a grant, so I've only written a grant, like big grant, once, you know, that was sort of independent, not like a postdoc fellowship or something that I worked on a team with. And I don't know how many hours of the day I spent versus a male counterpart. I never even thought about that, and that's interesting. I know I spent too little time on it because I decided way too late that I was going to write it. And I do remember talking to my boss the weekend before it was due and him saying, like, that was the first time he had a chance to really look at it, and he decided that it would be better to change all of it. Or not all of it, but most of it. And I freaked out because I was like, I can't do that. And he's like, sure you can. You have 4 days. It'll be fine. And I was just like, yeah, maybe it'll be fine for you because you've been doing this a lot longer. But it was clear he could easily, there was no problem for him. And he was totally someone that worked better under pressure last minute, which I am not. I don't like to procrastinate. I like to get things done early and have it very polished. But yeah, I had a slight breakdown, because then I was like, well, does this mean that it sucks? And I spent, you know, past however many weeks working on this, and now I can't change it. And it didn't. It got triaged. It was a K99, and it got triaged. And, you know, part of me is like, oh, what happened if I listened to him? It might have been written worse, but maybe the structure would have been better. And it's so hard to know what's the right thing to do, but I think the difference is, I wonder if someone, like if it was me as a male, would I have been able to just say, okay, I'm going to sit down for 4 days and really change this all around. I think that also was an eye-opener to me, thinking maybe academia wasn't right for me, because writing grants, and changing them around like that, I just feel like, I don't know, it felt painful at times. I would feel it was too much of a roller coaster. I would be so excited when I got something done, and then I would be really upset to find out that it sucked. And then I would rewrite it and be like, okay, I'm proud. This is, changed a lot, and I see where my mistakes were, and I tried to go through and really, you know, go sentence by sentence and really think about what I'm saying in each statement. But then still, it's not good enough. And I didn't like that at all.
Well, who can blame you? And the idea that you would rewrite an entire grant, an entire K99 proposal in 4 days is, it's amazing in and of itself and would require somebody to sit down and maybe spend 20 hours a day. Like that 4 days could contain 40 hours in some people's perspective. And that's the kind of thing that's impossible when you're caring for children or you're trying to, right. to deal with a family or, and it should be impossible for men too, but it seems like often it isn't because there's somebody there to take up the slack.
Right. And it's how you want to have your life organized. You know, I could take away, cause now I don't have kids and I could take away, leave everything alone and sit for 4 days and feel like I'm writing this grant. Nothing else matters. But I can't do that. Like, I want my place to be clean and I want to see other people. I understand that we're talking about 4 days, but let's say it was 2 months to write a grant because you do have to, like, lock yourself in your office and really work on this day and night. I don't have the ability to let everything else go to achieve success in one area. And I don't know if that's because I'm me or because I'm female, but I feel like that's more of a female quality.
Yeah, that's interesting. Let's talk about your work. So would you describe what you did while you were in D.C.?
Yeah, so I was a science policy fellow in D.C., and I worked for the American Society for Biochemistry and Molecular Biology. And basically, we're working on behalf of our members to, because I always thought of myself as like a glorified lobbyist, because I don't have any money, but I'm trying to convince people on the Hill that science is important. And so it's basically trying to convince that science needs to be funded, what's the best structure for science, and either supporting or opposing certain legislation that will affect how science is done in the lab, and knowing what's best for scientists versus maybe policymakers who are writing this that don't necessarily have the science background. But my the part I enjoy the most was grassroots efforts and helping scientists engage in activities that reached policymakers or congressional members to show how science is important and what science really is.
That it's such an interesting job, and I have 700,000 questions. So let's just start with, what do you think should be the turnaround between a research finding and its incorporation into policy?
Oh my God, I don't know. So I did policy for 10 months. I'm clearly not an expert, and having heard enough people speak about it, both here at Berkeley and when I was at DC, it sounds like it could take anywhere from, you know, it could go really quickly to 10 years. So I think it depends on what the topic is, and I think it's just ever evolving. We actually, for some of our students here, we did a science ethics, a postdoc ran a little science ethics presentation case study for them, and she brought up the example of GMOs and how that's been discussed for I don't even know how long, but it's still a subject that's always changing because new discoveries are made every day. And so I think that is it's very difficult to give a concrete answer to that question.
Explain to me what synthetic biology is.
Yeah, of course. So synthetic biology is this new emerging field, and they say it's engineering biology. So we're, you know, professors that work on synthetic biology are putting their efforts together to make biology easier to engineer. So it's taking a bunch of different fields like chemistry, biology, computer science, and engineering, and these different experts in these different areas work together, and they want to create methods that everybody can use, sort of like a registry of methods, and that would increase the speed, scale, and precision with which we can engineer biological systems. And then we can use that to help medicine and health and biofuels. So you're actually engineering the cell to do something very specific with an output. So it's a good combination of engineering and biology. And what's nice is SynBerk, which is a synthetic biology engineering research center, is the first real sort of consortium to bring together experts in this field. And it's almost like it's a new emerging field of biology. And SynBerk's this way to bring everyone together. And, you know, they have, you know, two retreats per year, and it brings all these scientists together to talk about their work and how it relates to one another and how they can collaborate and approach these problems. And also, it has a lot of industry partnerships, because you can imagine if you're engineering biology for some sort of output, it could be produced on a larger scale for a product. And so industry collaborations are also very important. And so right now, SynBerk just reached its 40th industry member.
So that sounds really complex. And how long has that field of science been around?
I don't know when it originated, but it is really recent. And SynBerk is Synthetic Engineering Research Center. That's an NSF-funded center. And so ERC grants go for 10 years, and SynBerk started in 2006. And that was the nation's single largest research investment in synthetic biology in 2006. So you can imagine it is a fairly new field. But, I mean, you know, I don't know the exact year and where things really spark. Because the nice thing about synthetic biology is there's a lot of scientists out there that do synthetic biology, and I think they're getting more and more integrated into the field now. So I would say it's still a relatively new field.
So what's your job? Are you the person that educates the public about what they do?
That's part of my job. So when you get an NSF grant, especially for an ERC, you have to have education programs. So part of my job is running education programs to encourage young people to pursue the field of synthetic biology, and we do that through undergraduate programs, teacher programs, and a high school program, and that's what I personally do. And then we also have other education individuals in SynBerk who have grown their own sort of educational programs. One that's very, or two that are very notable is the iGEM competition and BioBuilder. And my other job is that I'm the education and outreach manager. So, yes, part of it is educating the public on what synthetic biology is, especially if you're engineering biology and it's this new emerging field. You can imagine that you have to put in a lot more effort to convey to the public what we're doing. And when you're engineering biological systems to do certain tasks, it sounds like it could be on the border of something that is questionable. And so SynBerk takes a lot of efforts to make sure what they do is ethical and there are proper policies in place. And so from that part, you know, there's a policies and practices part of SynBerk, but I'm more the outreach part, where it's like the output of telling the public what SynBerk is. And those I haven't gotten a chance to work on as much yet, and that's what I hope to pursue in my position for the next 2 years.
At this point, what would you say is the most common question somebody asks you?
I think it's what you asked me, what's synthetic biology? Because it's so new. Yeah, a lot of people don't know what it is, even scientists. And even before I came to this position, when I was looking at the job description, I had to go and look at their website and watch their YouTube videos describing what synthetic biology is. Because when I was in science, which, you know, was a little over a year ago, I didn't hear about synthetic biology. I didn't take synthetic biology courses when I was in undergrad and in grad school. Now they're being offered. So I think that's the number one question, is just, what is synthetic biology? What is this new field that's coming out, and where is it going to take us?
This is probably an unfair question, but what would an undergraduate synthetic biology class look like? Like, what would the chapter headings be in the textbook?
I think they have different, like, you can think of it as different biological parts. You learn about different biological parts, but it's also a lot of microbiology, because they're using mostly E. coli and yeast to do that as the systems that you're using to engineer. And I'm not really sure, but we have a lot of courses and curriculum that you can ask for on our website. I'm not an expert in that, and I have never looked through. I have them all in files on my computer, and I have yet to look through the fine points of all those courses.
What is the website? Where would people go for information?
You can just go to synberc.org, and that's synberc.org, and there's all this information about what we are, what resources we have, what type of research we do, and industry, about our industry partnerships and about our education programs. And we also have a Facebook account and a Twitter account.
Great. Afraid ever that there aren't as many women in science because women don't really want to be in science, and we're all freaking out and it really isn't an issue?
What do you mean, like they don't really want to be in science because they don't like science, or because they're just scared of what the job entails?
Or what the job entails is not what they want to do. We need to change the job is what needs to happen.
Yeah, exactly. I actually think I'm not scared of that. I think that would be a great thing, because I think the job of a professor really does need to change. The expectations are they're very lofty, and I am someone who has very high expectations of myself and all those around me. But, like, asking someone to work, like, 24/7 is kind of ridiculous, and a lot of what the demands are on professors is just too much. And especially women, because it's like, oh, you're the only woman in the department. You need to be on this committee. We need a woman on this committee. We need a woman on this outreach committee, this student's thesis committee, or for teaching courses. I'm clearly not a professor because I don't know any of these committees. But you're stretching people really thin, and they're not being able to do the work that they want to do, they need to do, and the work that will really advance us forward as a population. Like, science, there's a lot to be discovered in science, and now is the time, especially biology, and now's the time to do it. And, like, if people don't like their jobs, then regardless of that, it needs to change, because it's not... There's a lot of things that aren't working with the system right now. And so I think the more support to why the system isn't working will encourage and convince people to change it. At least I hope so.
I totally agree. I, you know, maybe it's just because I've been through some layers of sexism that hopefully younger women don't have to face, but there's always this backstory or unspoken accusation that if you can't work 24/7, then you can't do the job. And I don't want it to come, I guess that's what I'm scared of, is that it's going to come across that, well, women in general, but some people are just too smart to say yes to that. So then they're never in those positions.
And why is it bad? Because, you know, I had this high school program and I invited a professor, my boss actually, to speak, and she's a really prominent researcher. She helped start SynBirth. And when she was talking about her science, I was like, oh, it was an experiment or a technique I always wanted to try. And I was like, oh, I really want to do that. And when she was talking about how she loves being a professor and why, I was like, oh, yeah, it does sound great. I feel like such a failure that I didn't do it. But then the reality of it is, like, her life is crazy. She's, like, going here and there all the time. She works really hard, and she makes it work, and the reality of it is not appealing, but the idea of it is so appealing. And so I want it to be more okay for people to say, I don't want to do the reality of it, and that doesn't make me a bad person.
Yeah, or for the reality and the actual day-to-day match the fantasy of it or the idea of it.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. When everybody tells you, oh, you should have been a professor and da-da-da, it's like the fantasy of it makes me feel like a failure, but the reality of it makes me think I made the right decision in life, or maybe the smart decision.
How do you
like convey that? It's really difficult.
It is. That last statement that you said, maybe the smart decision, I think that'll be the end of this interview when I go through and edit it, because I think that's so powerful. It is. It's the smart decision for a lot of people. And I guess to act like there's something wrong with a person because they choose that. But then we have to understand why it's more common for women to choose that, why it's easier, or why it's more acceptable for men. I don't know.
Do you remember when that book Lean In came out by Sheryl Sandberg at Facebook?
I don't.
Oh, well, okay, so there was this whole sort of, it was supposed to be more of a movement than just a book. So she wrote this book, Lean In, about how women need to lean in more, meaning almost like they had to be more aggressive, and literally they had these lean-in circles where you would, it was a movement because it encouraged women to form these circles and, like, meet once a month and discuss issues in the workplace. So I think it meant really well, and it was about helping women move up in the career world and how to balance things in life. But someone made the comment, like, why do women need to lean in? Why do they have to be more aggressive? Why do they have to be more like men? Why isn't it that men should look to women and see the choices they're making and how they're approaching the workplace? Maybe that's a better way to function in the workplace. Maybe being more aggressive isn't the answer. Maybe leaning in isn't the answer, but the answer is like stepping back and reprioritizing and thinking about what's the most important thing and what's the most important way to get up the ladder. And I thought that was interesting, because at first I was like, oh, yeah, I'm all in, supportive of Lean In, and I like the idea of having these circles and speaking to women, and we tried to make one at UCSC. It didn't really go very far. I don't know how well it's continued. And having this approach of balance, having this approach of not having to be aggressive or be the loudest person in the room, I kind of respect that more, especially now with students. It's like, the loudest person in the room, I find the most annoying. And the one who's most aggressive tends to be not the smartest person. They're just the loudest person, so people start paying attention to them. They don't necessarily have the best ideas. And so I think that's a whole other issue surrounding it, and that's more of a general issue, not just about women in science, but...
How do you think you face problems differently than somebody who's, say, 10 years older than you or 15 years older than you?
Well, one, I think I'm still very immature. I mean, I'm still in my early 30s, and I think many times I don't let things roll off my back things that shouldn't bother me still bother me, and learning how to deal with that. Instead of taking it so personally or being sensitive to it, I think I'm hoping over time that I'll get better at that. And then I also think, when I talk to women who are older, it just seems like there's more perspective on the problem and that they've been through it before and they know a mature way to handle it. And I'm thinking about myself 10 years ago, I feel like I have grown in that aspect, and I hope to continue to grow in that aspect. And also, I think they can confront the problem better, and because they can think about it more clearly and think about their approach more clearly, so then when they confront the problem, it comes off as very, like, they can confront the problem in a very logical or a very professional way, where it's like, okay, here's the problem, here is why it's wrong, and here's how we're going to solve it in a very professional way instead of a very reactive way. And I'm working on that, and maybe that's just my personality too, but I find that the older women are, the more experience they've had, and the more experience you have, the better you learn how to deal with problems, because they're in these types of situations, because they're all very similar, and they have the same underlying theme. And there might be a better way to solve the problem where you teach the person rather than just getting mad or confronting the person.
Do you think that older women are more able to do that in some situations because they have more power?
Yeah, I think so. I also think when you're in a higher position and someone says something to you, you know you worked up to that position and you know what your qualities are and what your training was and what you can do, and that person probably has no idea. And I think, like, even in my job now, I'm still learning. All these programs are new, and when something goes wrong, the first thing I want to do is take fault for it, figure out what I did wrong, and fix it. But sometimes I need to just stand up for myself and be like, no, I did it this way, and this was my motivation, and maybe that was correct. It's just I haven't had the trial and error to back that statement up. But just because it went wrong doesn't mean it was necessarily my fault. And I think when you have more experience and when you move up in positions, that's someone saying that you made the right decisions, or you've done really good work to get to this high-level position. So the decisions that you're making tend to be maybe not necessarily the right ones, but they put you on a positive course, and they get things done. But then on the flip side, I think there's a lot of women who are older, who grew up in a different time than I did, that react very strongly to these topics. And sometimes I feel like it's overboard and that things are changing and things are getting better. And they might not be able to see that as clearly as I can.
Well, thank you very much. And I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to In Other Words on Montana Public Radio. I'm Ann Zaldapetri, and I've been talking to Dr. Shayla Katadia about women in science. If you'd like to listen again or to past shows, please visit our website, inotherwordsradio.com. Thank you, and good night.